The first item on the agenda is to approve the minutes of the regular meeting from October 9th. I get everybody look over their minutes, and there's no discussion. Can I get a motion?
I have a question. Josh, I didn't understand your drafting of the motion that failed, that passed. The way you wrote it, it didn't describe any of that.
Which motion? Are you talking about this first or the second?
The first one. The second one you described in detail. The first one you didn't. I'm just trying to pull it up.
Where it says after discussion, Mr. Kelly made a motion?
Yeah.
This was the exact language that was in front of the board.
No, I think the question, if I remember, is I think we tried to vote for a pause. It actually got a second. There was a vote for the pause that failed.
Right.
And then there was a vote for rejecting the COLA, which basically went down on a 5-5 vote.
There was a vote whether to pause the vote on the pause.
Correct.
And that failed.
Right.
Right, because that was 5-5. And yep. Then there was a motion to pause, which did not get seconded. That's what happened.
Right.
Right. There was two. It was the pause on the pause got a vote, which failed 5-5. The second motion that Rob made to actually just pause the COLA and not pause the pause, didn't get a second, so it didn't get considered.
Right, but the first one you cited the motion, and you cited the discussion, and you cited the vote. You cited the votes, but there was not an outcome, unless you infer from the vote count.
Well, it says seconded the motion. If you read at the bottom, Mr. Walter seconded the motion, which failed by the following vote.
Right. I'm talking about the first vote.
There were two. I thought there were two votes.
I thought there were two votes.
Because there was a first and a second for both.
No, there was not a second,
there was no
second for the second motion.
Right. There's only one vote.
So the language is very explicit to say that on the first vote, that was 5-5, that vote failed because it was 5-5.
Right.
The second motion, there was no second to the motion, so there wasn't even a vote.
Right.
Yes.
So that's what. So, and if you read it, the second motion says that the motion failed for lack of a second.
Okay.
So, I mean, happy to keep trying to, keep talking about it if it's not being clear or if it's not clear to you. But the motion that got voted on was the pause on the pause.
Yeah, we didn't vote on the actual pause because that motion never got a second.
Right.
Huh. Yeah, we need better audio video equipment because I thought I seconded that, but I'm not going to die on that hill because I'm old. So I think I understand, and I think I remember incorrectly.
Well, we actually do have an audio of that
right.
item. We can go back and listen to it.
No, I don't think that's necessary.
I remember it differently, so that's
yeah.
what I was asking.
I thought there was a second motion, but like I said, I've slept since then.
Okay, so now that we had discussion, can I get a motion to approve the minutes?
Yeah, that's why I said I'm not going to die on that hill.
Okay. We got a motion and a second. All in favor of approving the minutes from the October 9th meeting, signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed, say nay. Hearing none, the motion passes. Non-public comments. Do we have anyone who wants to comment? R5 on your phone, I believe.
Nope.
Go on to the financial audit.
Thank you, Tag. Good morning, everyone. Today we will be covering several financial items. We will start with the 2024 financial audit. BDO will review the audit process and the audit results. And if you recall, I presented the preliminary financial results back in February, and as part of reviewing The next item, the annual comprehensive financial report, or the ACFR as we call it, I will go over those I'll review the highlights of the 2024, along with the ACFR presentation, and to show you all of the great information that is included in this ACFR report. Then Tony and the audit committee will review report on the audit committee meeting, and we'll end with the 2026 proposed budget, the second reading of that 2026 budget. So at this time, I'll turn it over to Carolyn Lattice, who is our BDO assurance principal, and Matt Liu, who is our audit senior manager, to discuss the audit process and the audit results. Carolyn?
Thanks, Brenda. Just confirming you can hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great, thanks. Okay, so I'm going to go through the results of our audit. We performed the audit in, I'm getting a little feedback here. Let me just quiet my phone. Okay, sorry about that. If you look to page, page 14 of the slides there, this is the presentation that we're going to go through with you all about the audit that we performed. First, I'll go through a summary of the audit procedures that we performed. We'll walk through some of the results, talk through the controls that we looked at over financial reporting, and some of the risks that we looked at as we went through our testing. And then we'll go through some of the required communications that we have with the governance group. So moving on to slide five with the executive summary there, as far as the results of our audit, so we'll kind of talk through our timing, but everything is complete on our end, and we've gotten our representation letter from Brenda and Kelly. Everything is closed down, and we're ready to issue the reports once we have the approval of the board and the audit committee. We'll go through all of the things that I just discussed a minute ago, and then we'll have some time for any questions that anyone might have. Okay, so flipping to slide seven, and this is the overview and status of our audit. So we went through all of our testing and completed most of that work over the summer. We did work over the actuarial valuation and investment valuations, wrapping everything up here in the last month or so, and went through the financial reporting with management, and we're basically substantially complete with everything, and going to report our results to you all with everything looking pretty good on our end. So slide 19 there, as far as the quality of the system's financial reporting, as part of our audit, we look at the full totality of the financial report, make sure that it's in line with governmental accounting standards as far as like all the disclosures that are included. We also look at the methods that management uses to develop estimates and the numbers that are reported in there, and evaluate whether or not the financial reporting looks clean to us. And happy to report that there was no issues there. So we'll go through in detail some of the bigger areas that we looked at, but yeah, overall nothing, no errors or issues that we came across. So moving on to slide 20. So at BDO, we take a risk-based approach to our audit, meaning that we allocate our time and resources toward the areas where we see the biggest risk, whether it's financial reporting risk, a fraud risk, or just the general estimate risk, that we spend a lot of time looking at those areas. So these are the three areas that we consider a significant risk, which are elevated kind of above all the other areas that we look at. So first of all, we look at management override, and this is a required significant risk in any audit. So we look here to make sure that there's no areas where management could override controls in place to prevent fraud or errors from occurring. We spend a good amount of time here looking at any adjustments management's making, and then also performing inquiries with third-party service providers, such as trustee, actuary, anyone that's got any hand in, you know, those numbers that end up in the financial report. And everything came out clean here, so no issues. And then the other two areas that we consider significant risks for the system financial reporting are the actuarial valuation, and that's due to its significance as the, you know, the largest liability for the pension system. And then the alternative investments, which are investments that are not, not publicly, no public pricing is available for those. So these are limited partnerships, that kind of investment where we do a little bit of extra work. And I'll touch on that in a minute here. Okay, so flipping to slide 21, we did not have any corrected or uncorrected misstatements, so everything was clean as far as the reporting, as far as the reporting goes. We didn't have any errors that needed to be addressed by management. And then similarly, moving to slide 23, so part of our audit process is to do a look at internal controls over the financial reporting process. So we look at, it's, you know, the controls in place at the system and then at some of the service providers as well. We did not have any issues that came to light during our reviews of internal controls or during our substantive testing. So so nothing to report there to the board. And on this slide here is kind of our information about what would be reported if we had found it. So any control deficiency that we consider either significant or to rise to the level of like a material weakness in internal control would be reported to you all. But as I mentioned, nothing here to report. So that's good. Okay, and then moving on to slides 25 through 27, I'm going to talk through some of the significant risks and the procedures that we perform there in order to get comfortable with those areas that are a little bit riskier. As far as management override goes, you know, we spend a good amount of time here. So any of the adjustments that that the management's accounting team is making to the trust statements in order to arrive at financial reporting, we look at all of those in detail, make sure that any calculations are appropriate and that they've been reviewed and approved by the appropriate levels of management in order to be processed into the financial statements. We do inquiries at JP Morgan, STP, you know, with the actuary, making sure that there hasn't been any instruction given by management to make any changes that were not appropriately authorized, and there were none, so nothing to report there. Okay, the next item is the actuarial valuation. Again, this is an area that we spend a good amount of time. We have our own internal actuaries at BDO as well that that take management's experts. We take the Siegel reports on both the main plan and also the supplemental plan, and we look at any inputs into those valuations, make sure everything is proper. So we test the census data, which is a major input, you know, making sure that there's that any changes to the census are correct. We do a sample there and kind of, you know, look at everything that's flowing through to the actuary. And then we look at the assumptions that the actuary is using and the methodology they're using to develop the funding and the liability as well. Our actuaries, you know, did a full review of that calculation and had no issues with any of the assumptions or methodologies used there.
So to understand that, and then also I want to circle back to ALT. So on actuarial valuation, essentially what you're saying is you check the assumptions, you check the procedure to make sure that they're in compliance with generally accepted standards, and that's what you do because everything else is simply how someone chooses to cook the meal. Is that essentially what you're saying?
Yes, so that's basically what we're saying, and we can get the from the actuary's report, you know, they detail out enough of their methodology that we can get comfortable with how they're developing it. We review the assumptions up against, you know, like industry standards, other benchmarks. And then that's what our internal actuaries, they're accredited actuaries and kind of do this work as well. Just make sure that everything looks in line with what they'd expect to see for similar pension systems. So, yeah.
So essentially, they're corridors of outcome, but the assumptions and the approach are essentially the thing that is the unifying theme.
Correct, yes. Mm-hmm.
Got it. Thank you. And then one... One other question, sorry, and then I'll stop. With regard to alternative investments, and I'm kind of looking at you too, is given that we are actually going to be doing more in the space going forward, I think it's an area of some focus. So essentially, you take the marks from the manager, and there's a bullet point that you then kind of sort of test them for validity. Can you give us a little bit more detail on kind of what that looks like? And then, Ryan, if you give me your thoughts as to whether or not you think this is something that we might need a little more policy on. But
yeah, I can let you know what we do. There's a kind of an array of and a spectrum of alternative investments as far as what we do on the audit side. So there's certain alternatives that are funds that we can obtain audited financial statements for. On those types of funds, we're able to rely on if we can get a copy of those audited financial statements and see that they were, had a clean opinion, were by an accredited auditor. We can rely on those as far as like getting the valuation of that investment. There are other funds, and there's some, a couple of private equity funds that Lone Star and Huff funds specifically, where management has elected to have their own valuation completed, whether because of the timing of the audited financial statements coming out too late for us to rely on, or other concerns about the numbers that the funds are reporting, they elect to complete their own valuations. So we take management experts' valuations, and that those are the valuations that are done by Kroll and by Upwelling. We take those, and we have our own internal valuation experts as well that take those reports, look at whether it's whatever kind of assumptions. Again, it's very similar to the actuarial review that we do. We look at assumptions that they're using, whether it's benchmarking, other comparables that they look at when they put together their valuation, and then they do like a high-level review of the methodology. They also will, because there's a little bit more leeway in evaluation for an investment, there's different ways to do it, different things you can look at. Our valuation experts actually also do a parallel valuation and make sure that if they were to use, like BDO has its own set of benchmarking that, we might have a different set of benchmarking than, say, like Upwelling uses. We'll like look at it from those benchmarks, run our own side valuation, and make sure that we're ending up within, an acceptable range of what the Upwelling valuation is. And then that way we can kind of independently get comfortable with the information and the value that's winding up on the financial statement. So that's the work we do around alternatives.
Yeah, I think I got it. I'm not that smart, so let me break it down simply to make sure I understand it. So if you have a manager that's using a valuation service and audited financials, you essentially bookend into that process. If you have a manager that does internal valuations, we have Upwelling and the other firm that you mentioned. So Giancarlo basically does a valuation that then you go spot check with your own valuation experts, and effectively you serve as the audited financial provider. And I'm quoting that because you're not, but the audited financial provider in the absence of having a larger sponsor with a valuation service plus a auditor that you can back into. Is that essentially the process?
Yep, that's exactly right. Yep.
Okay. Ryan, are you okay with that?
Yeah, I mean, I would say based on what we described, like in situations where we don't believe the GP's valuations, it's kind of on us to say that something's wrong here.
Right.
We need to have someone else value it. And in that case, BDO can't rely on a set of audited fair value financials for that fund and our investment in that fund, so we get a third party and they do a lot more work around that third party valuation.
Last question. Do you think that's what we would also do if we start doing co-investments, or we would just take the mark from the manager if the manager is using a valuation service?
I mean, if the co-investment, I'm not sure if co-investment pieces are usually separately, independently audited, or you just get
them. They're not.
Okay.
So I'm saying,
I think in that case, we'd have to kind of have BDO test the valuation just like they're doing on Huff or Lone Star for that piece, because they can't rely on the audited financial for that co-investment piece.
Got it. Thank you. I'm good.
Is our investment policy even allow for anything that's not the manager? Like, my assumption of co-investment is almost kind of direct, isn't it?
Yeah, it's, I have a...
It can be alongside a manager.
Correct.
Typically, it's alongside a manager.
Yeah. I mean, I would say right now, we're...
It's almost always alongside a manager.
Yeah. It would be like, we've talked a few, we're not really set up to do it right now, but right. You would be, you know, either pari passu in every investment they make in the fund or on a one-off basis.
Right.
We need to kind of get some fund investments, and that's something we evaluate down the road, I think.
Yeah, and I think the other issue is, given that you've done the hard work of cleaning up the past, I think it's time to revisit what we're going to do going forward with mm-hmm. alts, because, again, I think we're about to get a really good moment in time mm-hmm. to do some secondaries, some co-investments, and some directs.
Yeah.
If I could add one additional comment. Also, we'll have access to the data rooms by the managers for the co-invest evaluation if we so desire.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so in that case, like they should be doing valuation work. We shouldn't have to go pay Kroll to go do valuation work. I think BDO would just need to do work with the manager of the co-invest to kind of...
So we almost have triple redundancy if we have any questions.
Yeah.
Excellent. Okay, I'm good. Thank you.
Okay, sounds good. So we can move on then to slide 29. Okay, and then here we're just talking about significant accounting practices, and I've already kind of touched on some of these, but as far as significant accounting practices, here we're talking about significant estimates. The two biggest estimates we've got is investment valuation and then also the pension liability. So, and again, we've kind of already talked through those, but, you know, let me know if you have any questions on those. Okay, and then slides 31 and 32 go through other required communications. And I've gone through these with the audit committee as well, but I can touch on some high points here. Basically, the other required communications are communications required under the auditing standards for us to share with you. We didn't really have anything here to report. Anything that was, you know, information that we needed to report was included in the prior slide. So here we're basically saying that we don't have any issues. There were no significant changes to anything. The accounting treatments are appropriate. No significant and unusual transactions that impacted the financials, and no other issues that we noted during the audit. On slide 32, see, we look here at as far as any other significant issues that we work through with management, really nothing there that needs to be reported. You know, we're always having discussions and kind of brainstorming ways that we can get things done earlier. So that's, you know, just been a discussion, but nothing really that impacts the 2024 reporting. And then as far as any disagreements or issues with management, nothing to report there. It was a good collaborative process, and everything, I think, worked out really well. Okay, moving on to slide 33. As you know, we're required to be independent of the system, and we are independent of the system, as we confirmed in our engagement letter. And just a reminder that it is also, independence is going to two-way street. If you are aware of any transactions or anything with BDO that we may or may not be aware of, feel free to come to me. We can vet that out, make sure that it's not an issue, but nothing that we're aware of at all. Okay, and then the last item here is on slide 35, and that's just the information that we've obtained from governance. And this is information I was, you know, with you guys live back in April. We went through these questions there. If there's any changes or issues that you're aware of with regards to anything either impacting the financial statements or any of the information that flows through as part of our audit, you know, you can always reach out to me, let me know. But other than, you know, other than that, no one's communicated anything to us that's changed since April, so that's good. And then, as I mentioned before, we are complete with our audit, so once you all have a chance to go through the financial report, I believe that we are ready to issue. So the last couple slides here of our presentation are just some BDO information. So I think that's all I've got as far as our formal presentation. Any further questions for me before I hand it back over to Brenda?
Thank you. I believe we're going to need a motion. If no one else has any questions, I'm trying to get back there just a moment. To approve the issuance.
Did we get a motion to approve the issuance of the 2024 audit report?
I'll make the motion.
A second?
Second.
All right, all in favor, signify aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Signify by saying no. Hearing none, the motion passes. And move on
to you. Thank you, Carolyn and Matt. We appreciate you joining our meeting today and appreciate your partnership as we worked on the audit this year.
Great. Thank you, Brenda. Thanks, Kelly.
Okay, the next item that I'm going to go through today is what's called our annual comprehensive financial report, otherwise what we commonly call the ACFR for short, and get through the financials here and we'll get started. Bear with me for a moment. Almost there. Here we are. Annual Comprehensive Financial Report. The first question, perhaps, for those of you who haven't seen an ACFR before or who haven't seen DPFP's ACFR before, is what is it? And what it is a detailed and thorough presentation of the pension system's financial condition. It reports on the pension's activities and balances for each fiscal year. So as we start in looking at the ACFR, you'll see on page 114 the table of contents. There are five sections of an ACFR. There's an introduction, a financial, investment, actuarial, and statistical section. So as we start with the introduction, the first thing that you see is a transmittal letter. And the transmittal letter discusses DPFP, its history, its major initiatives, funding, financial results, investment portfolio, and other important information. It also discusses the awards that the system has earned or been awarded. You see here on page 117, the General Finance Officers Association, or the GFOA, awarded the system the Certificate of Achievement for Excellence in Financial Reporting for our last year's report. We have no reason to believe that this year's report won't also earn that award as well. We've also earned the Public Pension Standards Award for Administration. So after the transmittal letter, we will come to a section about Board of Trustees. We'll see your smiling faces. This page shows the trustees that were in place as of December 31st, 2024. And then on the next page, we show all the changes that have been made during 2025. And the last, pardon?
Can we go back to that slide for a second?
Yes.
Why are the new trustees so much better looking than the old trustees?
I don't have an answer for that one.
I have an answer.
Sorry, go ahead. You're trying to be serious.
No, no.
Wait till you get out the door. You're going to have some trouble.
The last thing in the introduction section is an administrative organization chart and all of our professional, our professional advisors. Then we'll move on to the financial section. This financial information is exactly the same thing as the audited financials that BDO was just discussing. So we kind of, it's not quite drop and play, but almost is what we do here for this financial section. So the first thing that you'll see in here is the BDO report on the audit of the financial statements. And here on page 128, again, And that second paragraph, you'll see the clean or unmodified opinion that we received for them for 2024. The next item is the management's discussion analysis, or MD&A. It's 7 pages in total and provides a high-level summary of the activities of the plan during the past 3 years. If you're looking for a place to start or you only have 5 minutes, this is the place to go to, right here on management discussion and analysis. Within the management discussion and analysis, you'll see summarized combining statements of fiduciary net positions. This presentation shows a 3-year comparison. The net position of the plan for 2024 was $2.034 billion, and that's an increase of $80 million over the prior year. And while benefit payments continue to exceed contribution payments, the shortfall was offset by investment gain in 24. As we move to the next page and we look at the summarized combining statements of changes in fiduciary net position, look at a couple of items here. The 2024 city contribution amount increased by $17.3 million, or 9.8%, over the prior year, and that's due to increased salaries, increase in the number of employees, and changes in the funding methodology. The member contributions increased by $5.4 million, or 8.6%, over the prior year because of the increased salaries and the number of employees that were contributing. Net investment gain of $176 million during 2024 was primarily driven by the increase in the public markets. These same financials are shown on pages 140 and 141, but they are split into the combined and the supplemental pension plan so that you can see each of those plans separately as well as the total. So you'll see combined, supplemental, total for 24 and 23, and you have a comparison there. The notes, so that's the same for the statement and the changes statement. The notes begin on page 142, and the notes provide important information about the financial statements and the overall financial status of the plans. On page 142 and 143, you'll see tables summarizing the plan's membership. And this is kind of the first of a variety of tables that you'll see throughout the report talking about membership in different ways. Here on 142, you see the combined plan and total non-active members decreased from 5,952 last year to 5,919. That's a decrease of 33%. And if you look at active membership, it has increased by 225 from 5,131 in 2023 to 5,356. The next page has the supplemental information, same format, much less volatility there. There's the active members increased by 6 and the non-active members increased by 6 and active members increased by 1. So the next thing I want to specifically mention is note 3 here in the notes. And it starts on page 153. So this is the investment section within the financial section. And it provides detailed information and comparisons about the investments. Here on 153, you see the fair value comparison table, and the fair value of investments increased by $64 million year over year. Also included in this section are fixed income maturity tables, you have foreign currency tables, you have credit risk tables, so a lot of good information about the investments here in this investment note in the financial section. The last part of the financial section is what is called required supplementary information, and it begins on page 175 right here. So this is good trending schedules in this part of the financials. It's that show financial information by plan for the last 10 years, has a history of plan changes, investment returns, and detailed expense information. So here's 5 years of the combined plan, another 5 years, then you see the supplemental plan for 10 years, then you see a list of all of the changes in benefit terms. As you go through, there's contributions, and you'll see the investment returns, and then all of the information on expenses here. So the next section that I want to move to is the investment section. So this section begins with a letter from Makita. It talks about the activities, the initiatives, and the performance of the investments during the past year. Here on pages 205 and 206, you'll see this investment table. It includes 1, 3, 5, and 10-year returns by asset category and asset class, and it's measured against the benchmarks for those investments. So for 2024, the time-weighted investment return was 8.1% on the overall portfolio.
Just out of curiosity, I'm sorry, and it's a bit of a history lesson, or maybe it's an actuarial lesson, but why did the actuarial liability jump so much between 23 and 24?
Because the board adopted the plan, and the big increase was, so the actuarial liability.
So it jumped by almost a half a billion dollars.
So that's due to the COLA. The reason I paused, I was wondering if you were talking about the 1/1/25 valuation, because that is a combination of the COLA and the new assumptions from the experience study.
Okay.
The GASB net pension liability doesn't have the new assumptions in it, just the timing difference.
I got it.
The experience study 2023?
The experience study was 1/1/25. Okay. So it's in the valuation in this one. Yeah. It's the GASB numbers are always lagged a year. So the assumptions changes are not in the GASB numbers, but they are in the.
Would part of that be pay increases too for this year?
Well, that's the assumption changes, okay. Yeah.
But that's in the experience study.
Right. Yeah.
So it's what I thought it was. Okay.
And of that half billion, how much is it attributable to each?
Most of it's the COLA for this year. So the COLA cost was So last year when they did it, it was $417 million. This year when they did it, it's $451 million. But does that include the assumption changes in the $451? Do you know, Brenda?
I think that it does.
So probably $417 million is a good estimate.
And are we smoothing, because Ryan crushed it with a 13.9 return. Are we smoothing that return?
We are smoothing all the gains and losses, including the investment return for 5 years.
Okay.
So make sure I understood. So 417 of the half of the 500 is attributable to the COLA?
Right.
Also included in the investment section is information about the asset allocation. So you'll see the target allocation. You'll see the current allocation. There's also charts comparing this year to last year, looking at broad asset category, looking at it by asset class. This is probably one of the best charts that really tells the story of the last 8 years. You look at where it begins, the first quarter of 2017, we had less than 10% invested in global equity, and the incredible work that's been done over the last 8 years to get us now we're at 50%. So this really, in a quick glance, this really can tell you the story of what's been happening here. There is also information in this section about management fees. We paid a little over $8 million in management fees, or 40 basis points on the average market value. We also include information about the largest public equity and fixed income holdings. So in 2024, our largest holdings were the Taiwan Semiconductor and NVIDIA. And then you have a list of investment managers. So again, a lot of great information. The next section is the actuarial information. And this has highlights from the actual actuarial report that was previously presented to the board. Starts off with a letter from Siegel. Then it talks about the funding. And just as a reminder, the combined pension funded ratio was 32.2 at 1/1/25 and 32% at 1/1/24. Also goes through a bunch of the assumptions. You'll see a lot of charts in here talking about payroll growth, about salary scale. Here on page 224, there's one on turnover. It's separated by police and fire, and let's go down to years of service, 9-10. This says that 2% of the police officers that have service in 9 to 10 leave, and with fire, it's 1%. So interesting information there. Again, throughout this section, a lot of information about members, and I want to particularly on this one, more to the end, sorry. So the last section here is the statistical section, and the statistical section provides, again, additional historical perspectives. It's good trending with 10-year schedules. You'll see in this section a term that you may not have seen before called consolidated plan, and that's simply the combination of both the combined plan and the supplemental plan together for these schedules. It'll start by telling you something about describing the schedules that you're going to see here. And as we go through here, we'll highlight a couple of them, distributions by type, both in chart and table form. If you want to see, you know, what's being paid out, how much in each category, you can do that. If you want to see benefit recipients by type, you know, how many of the members that are receiving a benefit and what pay ranges, you know, the 5,677 that we paid at December 31st, how was that broken down? You can find that here. Yearly retirements by service years. So let's just go all the way to the right in the bottom. You'll see 2024, we had 118 retirements. 15 of those had 30 plus years. 36 of those had 26 to 30 years. So again, 10 years of information to look at there. The last one I'm going to mention is the membership count. So we've seen several different forms of the membership count. This one is all-inclusive. If you're an active member, if you're a retiree, if you're a beneficiary, again, let's go to for the combined plan, that last row for 2025 and to the right, we have a total of 11,275 members that we serve. So I hope this introduction to the ACFR picture interest. Anytime you need information on the system, the ACFR is always a good place to start. Prior years are posted on the website from 2014 and forward. Hard copies of the report will be printed, and they'll be at your spot here on the table next month when you come for the December meeting. We also have a soft copy if you would prefer that. I do want to say preparing the ACFR is a group effort, and I want to thank Bill and Larissa in the accounting team who do most of the heavy lifting and putting together the ACFR. Melissa, who does a wonderful job of selecting the photos and compiling the ACFR. John, who does a great work in gathering up all the data. And then we have Ryan and Kyle and Luis, who from the investments team who put the investment section together, and of course Kelly for all of her help and encouragement. Are there any questions about the ACFER?
Just have a quick question. When you look at most of this information, obviously we're looking at it quite a bit in arrears, mostly because of the valuation issues. How much of this information is available by, say, the end of the first quarter after the year ends?
Certainly all of the demographic information.
It's all processed and these reports could have been put out if we had the valuations at that point.
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, we have to send it. Obviously, there's a lot of actuarial information.
Yeah, and you can't get that until the valuations are done. I get that.
We send the demographic information to the actuary, usually at the end of January or the beginning of February. Like, we've done all of our year-end work and it's off. With the financial section, you know, a good bit of those notes where we're putting together all of those tables about credit risk and all that, like, we have the information, we're putting that together in February and March and April. You know, we're working ahead and doing everything we can.
So it's all done and you're just waiting for those two numbers.
It's a lot of hurry up and wait.
Yeah.
Get this done and wait. So we are having conversations with our auditors and internally about how can we improve this. We recognize the value of receiving this a year later greatly diminishes the work and doesn't make it as useful as it could be. So we're looking to do something different for 2025 that you'll see in 2026. Any other questions? Okay, now I'm going to turn it over to Tony and the audit committee members.
We need a motion.
Thank you for reminding me.
John, will you go to page 111 or 110, please?
Yes, I can. I'm sorry.
Can you just, instead of flipping 100 pages, can you just type in the page number?
Oh, hold on a second. I got it. Note.
I'm not doing anything.
Do you want to read the motion? I have it if you don't have it.
Let's see if I can pull it up over here. Authorize the executive director to issue the 2024 annual comprehensive financial report and to forward the report to the Pension Review Board, the City of Dallas, and to post it on the DPFP website.
Get a motion.
Motion.
A second. Okay. A motion, a second. All in favor say aye.
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 Hearing none, the motion passes.
Okay, John, now we're on page 251 when you get back to it.
We have Tony.
Yep.
Audit committee meeting.
I'll go quick because it's going to be a pretty good summary of what Carolyn had gone through. So audit committee met at 8 a.m. Kelly and Brenda were there. Committee members Matt, Joe, Scott, and myself were in attendance. Carolyn and Matt from BDO were there. Carolyn kicked off and discussed audit process and results. This was the first committee meeting with this new group. In terms of summary process, everything for audit went smoothly, same scope as usual. BDO expects to issue an unmodified opinion. Quality of financial reporting is strong. Areas of significant risk are well managed. Noted that, kind of coming back to Scott's comment earlier, the Hoff and Lone Star valuation adds significant time to the final reporting. No issues with material misstatements, no material control deficiencies, no material weaknesses, no issues with management or management overrides. No communication issues findings to the report. We broke for executive session at 8:25. Kelly and Brenda left. Everything went. BDO thought everything went smoothly. Lots of praise for Kelly, Brenda, and the team. And then maybe most material, back to Scott's point, is we talked about. I will follow up with Brenda, Kelly, and BDO to try to figure out a way where we can get a preliminary report of some type. Summer-ish. Time frame, so more to follow on trying to make that happen.
Our goal and what we're working towards with the changes that we're going to make is to have the final report done by June 30. That's my goal.
First time I've ever done it before.
Okay.
Brenda?
Thank you, Tony, for that. So the last item I have is the second reading and discussion of the 2026 budget. It's back to me, or are you moving, John? Okay, here we go. Since we met in October, the budget was posted to the website. It was sent to the City of Dallas. We did not receive any feedback from the City of Dallas. There's only been one change to the budget, and it was an increase of about $43,000 for the TMRS staff retirement plan expenses that we discussed with the board in October. Here at the November meeting, the board may either approve the budget or direct staff to adjust the budget and bring the revised budget back to the board in December for final approval. And as a reminder, here is the 2026 proposed budget, $20.77 million, and that compares to $20.6 million from the prior year, an increase of $137,000 or 0.7%. The details of the budget are here at the end of the presentation if you would like to review those. Are there any questions about the budget?
I need a motion.
Motion.
Go back to the motion, please.
Okay. So approve the proposed 2026 budget and authorize the board chairman and executive director to execute the TMRS resolution increasing the employee contribution rate effective January 1st, 2026.
Your motion. I move.
Second.
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 A motion is second. All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Aye. Opposed? Say nay. Hearing none, the motion passes. A report on the Professional Services Committee, Steve.
Let me pull that up. Sorry about that.
Of course.
We had myself, Tag, Yvette. We interviewed with Makeda, Jackson Walker, and Siegel in Auburn on October 27th. The interview with Makeda was with Leo and Aaron attended from them, and they really had really their big thing was the performance of Ryan and how successful he's been and seeing his growth. And really making sure that we take care of Ryan and looking at him from a performance of him being picked off with that, but just really good feedback on the working with Ryan and his team and the board and what they do. Talking with Jackson Walker, we spoke with Chuck Campbell. And again, just their interactions primarily with Josh and Kelly and fiduciary issues, strong communication patterns, phone calls when board decisions intersect fiduciary matters, really positive feedback on them being heard and listened to and the advice that are given, which I think anyone in the services business can appreciate. And a clear understanding that the primary client is the board, and it's not just a rubber stamp for the staff, that interaction and how it behaves, and really just a really good working relationship. With Siegel, our interview was with Jeff Williams. Jeff really appreciates Kelly's work, really on top of things, keeps him informed, thinks Kelly does a great job. Really, some of the things that, if there's any concern, it's just the different pieces of how information comes in. You know, it is what it is. And I think that's just kind of an actuary kind of complaining of like wanting to do the same thing of where it goes. But again, really positive feedback with staff interactions, quick with data provided, answering questions, and really just no issue at all. I'm really impressed with the staff performance. Allborn, you know, that's the newest relationship. We interviewed Spencer Edge. He has biweekly calls with Ryan and the teams. Kelly often joins those investment calls. Again, good interaction with the staff. It's been limited just because it's new, but open communication line with Ryan. You can really get a hold of him when he needs to, and just really enjoys that back and forth of what's done. He's noticed the board turnover since he's joined, so he's getting to know the board members. And he's attended multiple investment committee meetings over the 12 months. And, you know, turnover on a board isn't unique. That's what they see often. But, again, all interactions, highly professional, understand the fiduciary role, and just, the open communication line. So all of it was really good, positive feedback from all of our service providers.
All right. Executive Director approved pension ministerial actions, Kelly?
Yes, I'll just go ahead and take the next three items. They're the three standard items that you have on every monthly agenda. The first one is the approval of the, just me reporting to you, the pension ministerial actions. So the report is in front of you. There was nothing remarkable or unusual about this month. We're on track. There were 9 new retirements, which is in line with what we've been seeing all year. So there's really nothing of note on this report. On the contribution update item, the next item, the format of this report has changed a little bit because the city started a new fiscal year, and in this fiscal year, the DPFP plan is based on the ADC that was from the 1/1/24 valuation, where in the prior year it was a fixed amount. So I've changed the format a little bit, but you can see the pink line is a 2024 shortage of almost $3 million. Fiscal 2025, the difference was $10 million. And so far, the first two pay periods this year, it's about $3.3 million. So in total, $16.5 million of the difference between the city plan and our plan. You'll see here that the big differences right now, and it will remain this way for this fiscal year, will be between the city's UAL payment of the $7.1 million every pay period and our UAL payment of $8.7 million. So about a $1.6 million difference that we'll have just in the UAL portion. And then there's a difference between the normal cost each pay period. So we'll just keep this going. I'll report that to you. The next page is the board approval of trustee training. Sasha has listed 2 classes for you, but just to remind you, you have a budget. You can add different classes to this. But this time, is there anybody that would like to get board approval to attend either of these classes or anything else? Okay, that's all I have on those 3 items. Thank you.
All right, so the board on meetings, seminars, and conferences attended. Again, CPERS, Credit Fiduciary Plan, and AS. I'll say this, I got a little more out of it than I expected. I do think that we should continue to send our police and fire trustees to this fiduciary training. I think it would be very rudimentary for a lot of you guys, but for police and fire, I think it's good information. It's good to see what everybody's doing around the country and get a different perspective. And I think I know more about CalPERS and some of the pensions in California than I ever did before. Overall, it was good. I mean, it's a little repetitive, and I think it speaks well to the training we have here. And I think just overall that and the CPERS conference overall, I think we gain a lot just by being there and seeing what everybody's doing around the country, just from all aspects, and what they're doing in Connecticut is a little bit different than what they're doing in California, what they're doing in Arizona, how everything's set up, especially on the police and fire side. It's just, you know, the networking and the exchange of information is outstanding outside of the conference, and you know, I didn't think the speakers were great at this conference, but it's always good to get out there. Like I said, the big thing is the fiduciary training. I would recommend going forward we send police and fire there, because I think there is some value there. Matt?
I thought the modules 3 and 4 were, I got more out of it because it was just, what questions do you ask as a trustee, and what do you look for in terms of accountability and whatnot? I thought I gained a lot of information on, I don't know if you call it an alternative investment, but a lot of pensions are investing in infrastructure within the cities, the general area, and where they lie. That was interesting. And they've been seem to be quite successful doing that. But I think the company or the gentleman that put it on are also selling this program, and they're definitely selling their services too. So yeah, there's a little bit of that. Canada is very different than the U.S., and very much so with Texas. So, I mean, I thought it was good. I got a lot of the networking as well, like Tag said. So, the 3 and 4 was better than 1 and 2. So if you decide you want to go to 1, I would say go to 3 and 4. Get to 1 and 2.
It's always entertaining to have people speak about ESG, and we're in a state where it's illegal. So, and you know, it's a
we wore the video as well. They continue to use us as the
video. I forgot to pull that out. They, because I brought that out to someone. I said, yeah, let's go to training. And the first video will be on the video they show here. And they did. But they, my biggest complaint in 1 and 2 was they were incorrect in the way they described it. They said it was a Dallas Police and Fire pension. And I pointed out that it was a real estate, you know, someone we used. It was being rated. It was the actual real estate vendor that we used. And so they corrected themselves and were much more accurate in the description of the video at this time. So that made me a little happier. But yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah, well, you know, and they were a little, they got it more of it right, so that was good. Let's see. Portfolio update.
All right, thanks, Tag. One correction. So I want to correct something I said earlier. There is a restriction in the IPS on co-investments in a single company, so that's just something to look at. It's something we added intentionally a few years ago, kind of after all the prior private investments. But like I said, we got some ways to go before we're there, but that restriction is in there right now. Okay, jumping into the portfolio update, up 13.9% for the overall portfolio, 16.1% for the public portion. Which is now just over 81% of the total portfolio. On the private market side, we've received about $21 million in proceeds year to date. We have good visibility to about another $40-plus million coming from the real estate portfolio in the near term, so we'd expect most of that to be received by year end. On rebalancing, we pulled $17 million out of the public equity portfolio in October. Given where equity valuation levels are right now, we're continuing to look at possible rebalancing opportunities. We're likely to tactically draw about 2% out of the public equity portfolio and hold that back in cash and fixed income over the near term. On the public equity discussion we've been having kind of at the board and the IAC level, at the end of October IAC meeting, we'll get a bit more detail on the next item, but we reviewed the public equity portfolio. Our plan is to bring some recommendations back to the board at the meeting next month on mainly small cap and global equity structure within that portfolio. Looking at investment initiatives, coming out of some of those tweaks to the public equity portfolio, we have likely 2 or 3 searches on the public equity side, and then I'm looking more at kind of 2026 and beyond, and then we also have plans for a second multi-asset credit search, so the team will be busy on both the private and the public side of the portfolio.
Ryan, are you kind of doing any preliminary research on secondaries?
Yes, I mean, we that's what we spent most of the time on the private equity side over the last 6 months. We've met with a ton of secondary managers. We're looking at potentially investing in single asset CV vehicles, so a little bit different way to play the secondary concept. We're likely going to bring 2 opportunities to the subcommittee in Q1 on the secondary and the CD side for investments. So looking more at investing into secondary funds right now.
Good. We'll see if we can't get you something to use.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I'll credit Tony for this slide, but there was a memo that came out from Oak Tree about a few weeks ago that it's Howard Marks, and he's talking about an experience where he was sitting in on kind of a consultant survey of a larger U.S. pension board. And it's pretty topical given a lot of the conversations we've had at the board level. It covers, you know, attitudes towards risk, setting objectives, what risk tolerance does the, you know, trustees and investment committee have across the portfolio, approach to investment, whether it's direct, you know, through funds, and assessing performance of both staff and the investment managers. So we wanted to share it with you guys. There's a podcast version that's like 30 minutes. It's a super easy listen, but it's very topical. And we've talked internally about, you know, maybe this is something we should consider doing as we get into whenever the next asset allocation study is, to kind of level set with some of the new trustees and make sure that all of our goals and objectives are, at least we have the collective view of everyone going into that.
I thought it was an excellent overview, and I think it has broad applicability even beyond the investment milieu, that kind of risk.
Yeah, this quadrant right here, like, I mean, kind of, it lays it out pretty simply, and I think that's the right way to think about, you know, how do we want to position the portfolio, and how does that align with our funding level and our, you know, investment return objectives.
Good gradient for anybody who's assessing risk and outcomes, regardless of what the organization is. I thought it was excellent reading.
Awesome. So year-to-date equity market returns, you can see U.S. international still outperforming U.S. with emerging markets leading the way, so maintaining our allocation there has been beneficial. As we get into the manager performance page, you know, note that it's all benchmarked against the ACWI, so that's up 19% year-to-date. ACWI is 60-plus percent U.S. The international has been continuing to perform well. Over the three-year period, this story is a bit different. U.S. Leading the way there. We pointed this out last month, but I'll continue to say it. 20-plus percent returns over a three-year period are not normal for equity markets, and we don't expect that to last. Looking specifically at Q3, there's a lot of bars on this chart, but it's looking at kind of U.S., developed ex-U.S. and emerging markets. And the interesting thing to note here would be that profitability, which would be kind of a proxy for quality, lower quality in both the U.S. and developed, especially in developed ex-U.S., lower profitability companies outperformed, which is, I think, what you're seeing with some of the underperformance in our portfolio, where the quality managers haven't kept up, you know, throughout this year. So I would say the underperformance is expected. If you look over to the emerging markets, in Q3, where the profitability, high profitability companies outperformed, I think you see that in our performance of RBC, who also has a quality tilt to their portfolio, with them outperforming over the near term. So kind of continued the same story on the public equity portfolio with Boston Partners and WCM outperforming, and the two, Manulife and Walter Scott, more quality-based managers, underperforming. Like I said, good performance out of RBC. Year-to-date, they're just right at the benchmark of 30.8% and outperforming kind of longer term. Moving over to the fixed income portfolio, lots of green here, which you would expect in the fixed income and cash. As a reminder, a lot of these managers have a bit more credit exposure than the benchmark, so we should expect outperformance there, especially in this type of market. And then in the credit portfolio, good performance across all of our managers on a one-year basis. Loomis, the high-yield manager, was the one that had been struggling a bit, and they've caught up quite a bit year-to-date. Any questions on performance or any of the managers? Okay, looking at kind of the bridge chart as of end of October, we're just under $2.2 billion, $271 million year-to-date in investment gain, $58 million net in benefit outflows. I look back at that number on the purple bar a year ago, and it was $85 million in outflows over the same time period. So it just shows kind of the increased contributions, the monthly outflows a bit less year to date. On liquidity, very good here, over target in cash and short-term bonds with $200 million in that portfolio, and then another $1.6 billion in liquid assets across the public part of the portfolio. So no concerns in terms of liquidity. And then this just shows the asset allocation detail. As I mentioned, we're likely to pull about $50 million out of the equity portfolio over the next week, given valuation levels. So with that, we can move into the next item if there's not any further questions.
Will you just be reallocating the $50 million to current fixed income managers?
Yeah, so our plan is to spread that across the cash allocation, short-term, and investment grade.
With so we'll be like overweight or anything depending on?
Yeah, we're going to be a bit overweight.
Well, overweight on fixed income, but
yeah.
Not per manager?
No, it'll be kind of pro rata. The two fixed income managers, IRNM and Longfellow, will be about 1% overweight to the target. So the next item is a report on the IAC meeting in late October. Tom, I got some notes here I can run through, but I didn't know if you wanted to cover this item or not.
Go ahead.
Okay, so as I mentioned, the large item we talked about at the IAC was the review of the public equity portfolio, went through a lot of different options and ways to allocate that portfolio, focus on small cap equities, what to do with that allocation, and then the positioning of having four active global managers. So we're going to bring a version of that presentation back to the board next month and go through some recommendations and a few tweaks there. And then we also went through our private market pipeline and the opportunities we're looking at, including the secondary funds, Arbor Lane, which we reviewed that with IAC, which is the credit manager we're about to talk about. And then as we kind of move the IAC's focus into next year, I think it's kind of getting a lot of these searches started and on the public side and running those through the committee. So any of the IAC members have anything else they want to add to that? All right.
Supplement the talk when we talk about the manager.
Yeah. All right, so the next item we have, and I'm on page 283 now, is a new private commitment that we're seeking approval on. It's a $10 million commitment to Arbor Lane Credit Opportunities Fund 4. Kyle has done a lot of work on this potential investment. I'll turn it over to him in a minute to cover the details, but I wanted to kind of take a step back and review where we've been, where we're going on the private credit portfolio. So this is looking at, in February, the board reviewed this pacing plan for private credit. In May, we approved two commitments to direct lending with KKR and Golub, so there's the $30 million at the bottom of the page in direct lending. We also have targeted another $20 million across distress, special situations, and multi-strategy lending. I guess on these pacing plans, it's a good roadmap for what we plan to do and how we plan to allocate the portfolio, but I don't want our team to feel any pressure that we need to deploy money to meet this pacing plan. So we're definitely not beholden to it, and we'll talk about kind of where Arbor Lane fits into this. But I think kind of long-term, it's a good, thing to update, keep an eye on. But like I said, I don't want to feel like we need to deploy $15 million to asset back to check a box. We're taking a best opportunities approach to the private market portfolio. So with Arbor Lane, it's a stress credit trading public strategy in a private fund. It doesn't fit neatly into any of these categories. I would categorize the $10 million as a mix between kind of distress, special situations, and direct lending. It should be a good complement to what we're doing in the direct lending portfolio. In early October, the subcommittee, which, as a reminder, that Tom and Tina from the board, and Jameel McNeil and Michael Brown from the IAC interviewed Arbor Lane, along with commentary from staff and Allborn. And then Tony has recently been added to the subcommittee, so he'll be helping out when we start looking at some private equity commitments coming up. So with that, I will hand it over to Kyle.
Great. Thanks, Ryan. So as Ryan mentioned, Arbor Lane is focused on publicly traded stressed and distressed loans. And we'll talk a little bit about where there's some potential for private credit, secondary traded private credit to come into that in a distressed cycle. But to give an overview of the fund as it is today, the fund takes advantage of four sellers in the market to attain attractive entry prices and discounts on credits. The team came out of Credit Suisse. It was one of the last prop desks that existed in Wall Street. They have a very long and deep track record in restructurings and workout capabilities. It's really one of their core competencies. There's also been some structural dynamics that have been very positive for what Arbor Lane does. The evolution and kind of explosion of CLOs within the publicly traded loan space, they make up a vast majority of all the entire loan market. They hold around 70% of all publicly traded loans. They're also very rules-based, and there's a high degree of herd mentality. They see one CLO manager sell a credit that they might already be concerned about and think it's going to drop out of their box and they're going to be a seller, and so they're all kind of rushing for the door. Where Arbor Lane fits in, they provide liquidity. They get paid for providing that liquidity in form of the discount. And when things do go to a restructuring, they have the workout capabilities to make it happen. They've been on over 180 different steering committees, creditor committees, boards over the track record of Arbor Lane, which goes back to 2016. Some of the other key pieces of this team that I wanted to touch on, the relationships with CLOs is heavily important, and I think one of the things they do well is how they actually trade in the market. This is very much like a trade by appointment type of market for these loans. It's very relational, very phone call driven. They use those relationships and the fact that many of these are forced sellers to push prices down drastically when they're buying. And many times CLO managers see Arbor Lane buying a credit and it might be trading at 95 and they're starting to think, maybe this thing's only worth 85, I should try and get out of it now. The CLOs don't have the workout capabilities, and so Arbor Lane's able to step in and really provide that expertise. Where this kind of plugs into a real complement for our existing direct lending mandates and why we think it's going to be a high value add to our private credit portfolio, while the secondary traded privately originated credit market is pretty nascent, you hear some shops talking about they're starting to have a desk, but it's really not a developed strategy. It's not something that exists in true form. Arbor Lane believes they have the relationships and believes they have the workout capabilities. That when we go through a real distress cycle and you start seeing defaults shoot up in private credit, you've had a lot of loose money chasing deals in direct lending. Many of those teams do not have the workout capabilities to handle all of the workouts that might come at them at once. And Arbor Lane plans to be able to step into that gap, provide liquidity to those direct lending managers, and go through a workout situation on a privately originated loan. A couple of things to consider, perhaps areas of vulnerability. There is a high degree of key man risk. The two co-founders, Bob Franz and Ken Hoffman, along with Dan Galantier, they make up the investment committee. They're very important to the success of the business. I'd say Bob Franz, who came in and spoke with our subcommittee, he is essential to the research and kind of driving the ideas in the portfolio. Ken Hoffman very much drives a lot of that relationships on the street, relationships with the CLO managers. So fortunately, there is a strong key man provision in the fund, kind of mitigates our concern. There's other very senior members of the research team that already play a significant role, already have some economic ownership of the firm. So there's kind of a path to succession there in the future, but did want to note that. And additionally, while this is a thinly traded part of the market and that creates opportunity for Arbor Lane, it also reduces the opportunities for exit. So if they aren't really able to turn around the credit, pull it to par, or take it through that restructuring, it can take a significant amount of time to kind of work out and get these loans traded out. So that's something to consider. It's something that you see in the DPI. of the previous funds. There is recycling during the investment period, so that plays some role there. But it's something we want to be mindful of, especially in the larger situations where they've had to take the keys. Those can take multiple years to play out, kind of do a full recovery story. With that, I know we have Spencer from Allborn is on the line. If there's any questions for Spencer, or if any of the subcommittee members who had the chance to meet with Bob and Dan, feel free to jump in.
So I was actually very impressed with them. They do seem smart, disciplined, and very cognizant that they have to get their team to do what they are doing. So there is this sense that they're, like with Ken, cultivating this idea that he can bridge the relationships or how they kind of have a relationship with the CLO managers or the sourcing mechanism. This is their fourth vintage, and I think they've done really well, and I believe we're coming to a close on the fourth, right? So this is kind of like the tail end of this fourth, and they had a lot of previous investors, LPs, coming into this as well. So I think that's also a good indication. I also went through the very arduous and very long 129 page of Allborn, and I skimmed over it before because I wanted to make my own conclusions, and then read it after, and it was very, 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 very detailed and very favorable. So,
yeah, I mean, final close is coming up at in the end of the year. They're at about $2.4 billion versus $2 billion target, so modest sized fund. Haven't seen a ton of growth kind of fund to fund, so they have pretty good controls on that side too.
They are, and they're very good about, like, they say they do what they say. That's the other thing. They've done what they've said, and they do what they say, which is good for managers.
And I think one other important thing to note is, the question of what if there isn't a distress cycle where we see those defaults tick up during the investment period, which is possible. I think most people in this room might think that's probably pretty unlikely. What they're doing now and where they're positioning is very much on performing stressed loans, where they're able to get them at a discount. It's more of a pull the par story than a restructuring, but they're able to shift very quickly when the market turns. And they demonstrated during COVID the ability to draw capital and get that into the market quickly when great opportunities presented themselves.
Well, it's remarkable if they're on fund four to generate those returns in what's basically been a benign credit environment the last decade, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm. It's just, one additional comment, and the IEC was in favor of this recommendation, but the team itself makes decisions based on unanimous cooperation and consideration within the committee rather than a one person show. Two, we're in a situation, economic cycle, where we could have speculation. We do have a lot of zombie, and accordingly, there's a lot of opportunities for it. All things considered, they really have tremendous workout capabilities, tremendous relationships, and strong recommendations.
And they also echoed that they do see a lot of cracks. They see a lot of cracks coming, and that they see those little spreads moving out, and so they're just mobilizing for opportunistically.
A couple of quick questions. Recycle, do they recycle income along with principal, or do they just recycle the income? I mean the principal.
They can recycle both only during the investment period that first 3 years.
And then somebody just mentioned returns. I see the target returns. Do we have anywhere the actual returns?
Yeah, I have it in the memo and additional confidential materials, but I will say we don't have the Q3 numbers yet, so this is as of 6:30. Fund 2, which is 2018 vintage, has a 15.1% net IRR. Fund 3 is lagging that around 12%. They expect that to increase. There's one significant large a true take the keys situation that's playing out there, and it's going to be probably another year or two till that really marks up.
It's helpful just to get a little context.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
To see if they're targeting their currents.
We'll be sure to include that in the slides next time around.
And it says whole fund waterfall, is that Are they doing, is it a European or an American water?
European.
It is European.
Yeah.
I thought that may be what you were, I just wanted to make sure.
Yeah.
Great.
And then we had the feedback when we brought the direct lending funds, where we're trying to get more kind of on this snapshot for the board to see. So if there's anything additional that you guys think would be helpful, let us know.
Okay.
As we evolve this going forward.
I have a question.
Yeah.
So if we feel like, you know, they're seeing some cracks in the economy and that spreads could widen further, is this the best time to be getting into this type of investment? Is there better to wait a little bit to get that opportunity to, you know, you can't time it per se, like,
right.
You know, exactly, but spreads are so tight right now, equities are priced to perfection. It's just a matter of, like, you know, knowing when the time is.
Yeah, like the spread at entry basically defines your outcome in credit.
Mm-hmm.
I think the benefit, and this isn't a trigger fund, they wouldn't call themselves a trigger fund. Those were very in vogue a little while back. People still talk about them, but we're like, hey, if spreads hit this threshold, we're going to call capital. That isn't what they do, but it's similar to what happened in COVID. When spreads do move out widely and they think that the risk-adjusted return is very generous, they move quickly. So they can call capital, move into the market. There's a subscription facility, so they're able to kind of manage, you know, hey, we aren't going to get the capital from LPs for another month because we have to give the notice, but we can get the money in the ground now. So they are able to deploy opportunistically when the opportunities are right.
I would add, like the multi-asset credit manager that we just hired over the summer, they, on the public side, should be able to do that and move their portfolio a bit more dynamically across credit asset classes if there is an event and spreads widen out.
Do we have any feel for how many times they've asked for a fund life extension and what you guys are thinking in terms of the actual duration experience you're going to see?
Yeah. Yeah, so... And one other thing I should have noted earlier, so we say Fund 4 here. Fund 1 was the legacy Credit Suisse portfolio that was purchased by Sixth Street. So that's called Project Bills, but that's Fund 1. So there's really only been two funds. Fund 2 had an extension. One thing that Allborn noted, and we noticed as well in the docs, is those extension agreements are pretty generous compared to what you see with most GPs. So there's a one-year extension at the GP's discretion, and then after that, it's majority LP approval.
Also, no LPAC approval for...
Yeah, it goes straight to the majority LP approval, which is normally, typically it's more LPAC, which, you know, we aren't necessarily having a seat at the table in those discussions.
Good. And you guys think the actual experience tenor is going to be the 3+3, or you think it's going to run a little longer?
I would expect 3+3. I think it is highly dependent on what we see happen in the credit markets over those two different chunks of the three-year period.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think we're about to get a back-up-the-truck moment.
Yeah.
So the evidence of bad pick, so pick that's added after the origination is significantly up. And to your point, that spreads have narrowed, which usually is a good sign that things are about to get really nasty.
Exactly.
So,
So if just, and hypothetically, just because of timing, if let's say we approve this investment today, when would they receive our investment? Because it closes by the end of the year, correct?
Yeah, so it's a drawdown fund. So once we close on it, they can call cap. There will be some catch-up contribution, and then they'll call capital as they're investing.
How much have they invested for the last close?
It's close to $2 billion.
I know they have some money in the ground. Let's see.
Yeah, we spent a lot of time talking through some of the larger positions. I'm just trying to see if I can find the total number here.
It would be nice if they have a lot of dry powder.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we would expect it, like, upon the final close, however much they've deployed the fund, a capital call pretty quickly thereafter to catch up for what they've drawn to date and then, you know, deploy over the next couple of years. And if we can't find that number, we'll follow.
That's okay. I was just curious.
I think that's relevant in terms
I just
of
was, it was
the
more,
we're talking about.
That was kind of going where David was going, like, oh, you know, is there a lot of dry powder? Or
yeah.
And,
I mean, I would say, like, these funds that are in demand, you know, they start fundraising pretty quickly once they hit the trigger of kind of deployed capital in the prior fund. So I don't think they haven't been in the market that long. So I don't believe that they've, you know, it's not like they've been in the market for 2 years and deploying money out of the fund. They just, you know, last year sometime probably hit the trigger to start raising a new fund.
I think 25, 26 are going to be some really good vintage years for a lot of stuff.
So if we get approval here, this will be the third private fund that we've approved on the credit side. Like I said, the next kind of what's up next is private equity, but I think we're kind of evolving this process with the subcommittee reviewing these funds, and it's going well. So appreciate the support. With that, we will need a motion for approval.
So the motion that I've written down is, I don't think it's on the discussion sheet, but it's, I would propose a motion of approve subject to legal review and final approval of the executive director commitment of $10 million to Arbor Lane Community Opportunity Fund 4.
Credit Opportunity Fund.
You got a long term in your mind.
Credit Opportunity Fund 4.
You know where I copied this from? I don't know.
I don't know.
Okay, thank you.
Not a CRA
credit
fund.
Okay. Thank you.
You got a second?
Second.
I got a motion and a second. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, say nay. Hearing none, the motion passes.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys. We keep hearing that from everybody. How good they are. Seriously.
Yeah. Okay, this next item is a Dell Gleason Fire Pension System Oddity. It came about as part of HB 3158 when it was passed in 2017, and it actually requires in the statute that on an annual basis I deliver a training manual to the board that covers specific areas that are defined in the process, and you're required to sign off an acknowledgement that you received that and that you've read and understand the ethics policy. So every November you can look forward to this
what they were doing before.
And we talk about it actually during the trustee orientation too, but we need to do it every month. So what we have here is just kind of screenshots for Diligent, and that's where you'll find it if you're ever looking for this information. So when you go into Diligent, this is kind of the home page, you'll see over on the left you've got the current book, the archive book, and underneath that is the Resource Center. So if you click on the Resource Center item, okay, if we go back. Okay, this is the right page, sorry. So this is, once you click on the Resource Center, this is the page that you'll be brought to. The second item on here is the Board Training Manual. When you click on the Board Training Manual, you will see the different chapters. There's 8 required chapters in this training manual according to the statute, and those are the 8 kind of chapters that are listed down there below. When you click on each one of those, it contains information, and I will tell you what's kind of in each chapter, and you can look at it whenever you want. So the first chapter, that chapter 1, is required to have laws governing DPFP operations. So what we have under that chapter is the full statute of the plan 6243A-1 and also the ordinance that governs the supplemental plan document. If you were looking for the full statute, it's easier actually just to get it off of our website, so I would recommend that rather than go in here, but that's what's in that first chapter. In the second chapter, it is has programs, functions, rules, and budgets. And by the way, none of this was really defined on what goes. It says what needed to be in there, basically programs, functions, rules, and budget. So we had to make a decision, what does that mean, what should go in here. So in this next chapter 2, we always put in there the budget. So we'll update the first reading of the budget with the budget that was just approved today. The next chapter, chapter 3, is rulemaking authority and limitations. What we have in there is a summary of all of the sections in the section 5243A-1 that talks about rulemaking or authority of the board in one place for you. Chapter 4 is the audit, so we've got the draft audit out there, and once we get the final audit, we will replace that. Chapter 5 has the most information in it. Oops, went too far. Okay, we have a new clicker, so we're all going the wrong way
yeah.
today. The buttons are different. Okay, we'll go back to. Okay, so in chapter five, it's laws, open meetings, public information, admin procedures, and conflicts. So in this section, we have the Attorney General's Open Meetings Handbook, the Attorney General Public Information Act Handbook. We have Section 551 of the Government Code, which deals with open meetings. Section 552 of the Government Code, which is Public Information, Open Records Act. The Government Code Section 171, Regulations of Conflict of Interest. And the Government Code Section 176, Disclosure of Certain Relationships. And then we also have, so that's what's in that section. And then, okay. The next chapter, actually this chapter is broken into two parts, other laws. So what we have in there is Section 802 of the Government Code, which is administrative requirements. And then we have the Texas Constitution Section 66 and 67. One of the things I did want to point out that was a change in the Section 802 of the code, which could impact this meeting in the future. This came out of this last legislative session. Previously, when we were required to post a meeting, it had to be posted 72 hours before the meeting, and that included non-business days. Now the 72 hours only counts business days. So that could, if we ever need a special meeting, it's just something we'll have to pay attention to. It doesn't come up very often. Okay, section, chapter six is the code of ethics and the governance policy. Those two policies are there for you. They're also on our website if you ever want to look at those. It's easier to get to that way. And then we're required to have training related to the risks of investing in alternative investments. So in that section, we have Investments 101 on alternatives, a presentation, and then we have a Makita presentation on private equity. So that is a training manual, and we're happy to add any other information that you would like to see in here, but we feel like this meets the requirements of the statute. Are there any questions about this item? Okay, so if you would, before you leave today at your places, you should have an acknowledgement that you received the training manual, and you've got the ethics. If you can just sign that and either hand it to Melissa or leave it at your place, I would greatly appreciate it. And we can mark that requirement off of our list. Okay. And with that, I think we can go into closed session.